once more under the breach, dear friend.
Now let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure on this Saturday, December 10th, 2016, which is almost over. 2016 is almost gone. And that's very strange to me, because to me, merely being in the 21st century makes me think I'm in a science fiction movie or something, and I guess I am, because I have a I have an iPhone in my pocket and a computer-controlled car, and to some degree, and as we race into the future. Well, the telephone number, if you'd like to give us a call in here, is 254-773-1400, and you're certainly welcome to discuss or ask any questions about anything to do with anything of economic investment, subject area, whatever. We were talking about fiduciary, the fiduciary rule on the way out. I'd like to kind of top that, finish that off with a very simple statement. If you're dealing with somebody who calls themselves a financial advisor, or you're dealing with an organization that is a national broker dealer, whether it be Merrill Lynch or A.G. Edwards, or if A.G. Edwards still exists, Edward Jones, or Wells Fargo, or whatever, you're dealing with a sales organization, and in some circumstances, they may say, well, over here, we're going to be a fiduciary with certain exceptions, but over here, we're not. They're not across the board. Fiduciary is not something, at least in our opinion, you can do part-time. If you're dealing with an investment advisor, or if you're dealing with anybody who's giving you advice about investments to purchase, in our opinion, you should get in writing from them, from the person you're speaking to, a statement that I will act in your best interests at all times. Just a simple handwritten statement, and then sign it. That's simple fiduciary rule. Now, could there be circumstances where there could be a conflict of interest? Sure. But an investment advisor, as opposed to a financial advisor, is obligated to not only disclose those conflicts of interest, but to mediate them and act in the client's best interest whenever it is humanly possible to do so. And that's just such a fundamental issue. If you go to an attorney, you assume that the attorney is not also acting for the person who's in opposition to you. They're going to charge you a fee, but they're obligated to, at all times, act in your best interest. If you go to a physician...
Well, just to real quick, if you are in the middle of a divorce and you find out that your attorney is also working for the spouse, that's called malpractice.
Yeah.
It's grounds for disbarment. It is totally unethical and not fiduciary.
And the same thing is true if you go to a physician. If you go to a physician, you assume this physician is operating in your best interest, is not prescribing medications because they get a kickback, a commission on the medications. They're not getting a commission when they prescribe a procedure that you need at the hospital. That's an assumption, and it is malpractice for them to get what we call kickbacks. In the financial industry, it's called commissions and bonuses and special bonuses and awards they get for selling, and the best, the people who in the financial industry who get the biggest awards are the, quote, top producers, and it doesn't mean that they produce the most for their clients, it or their customers. It means they produce the most for the company that's employing them, and they get big rewards for that. And the point is, they are not required to disclose those awards. It's a sales arrangement between you and that person. Our objection is very simple. We don't believe that financial salespeople should call themselves financial advisors. But that's all right. That's the way it is. That's what happened. That's life. They do call themselves financial advisors. Even though when you think about, if you hire a consultant to advise you, you expect that that consultant is going to have loyalty to you alone and not be doing it in somebody else's best interest. But that's all beside the point. That's back there. Some good news.
Are we changing subjects?
Yes.
I've got some good news,
okay,
too, or at least
too.
Interesting news.
Okay. PMI, 53.2%.
PMI, that's please my...
Purchasing managers...
Indigestion.
That is actually the November Manufacturing Purchase Managers Index. Now, anything above 50 indicates
Growth.
Growth. And we are seeing a high growth forecast among the purchasing, the people who purchase the raw materials for manufacturing. We are seeing the another thing that happened on Friday, the University of Michigan's preliminary consumer confidence index for December. Don't you love that? It rose to 98, which is the highest it's been in years.
What's the abbreviated acronym for that?
Consumer Confidence Index.
So CCI, the PMI and the CCI.
Yeah, well,
we can just keep going with
basically,
acronyms here.
These guys track what the average person out there thinks about the future, and they concluded that people are becoming optimistic. And as a big chunk of what's causing the market to rise at this point is a great deal of optimism, not only among just the average person on the street, but in corporate environments, in purchasing manager, in this case, corporate purchase managers. Some of that has to do with the election. Some of that has to do with the fact that it's just happening at this point. Things are beginning to build. They're beginning to see evidence that we are finally out of the doldrums and out of the slump, and there's a high potential. And I know, Jake, you've got some things to talk about. But there is a high potential that going down the road, we will see a significant rise in corporate earnings, a big one. If the tax cuts that President-elect Trump has proposed and the Republicans in Congress have said they want to push through. Now, where they're going to make up the difference, I don't know. They got to raise taxes somewhere else or cut spending, according to the law, but they may be able to get around that.
They may be able to change that law.
But the point is, the S&P 500, which is, you know, could easily go to 2,500. The saying, we could see the Dow Jones Industrial Average jump 10% just on the if the price earnings ratio stayed the same as it is, and we see a cut in corporate taxes. We could easily see, just on that issue alone, the earnings of the 500 companies in the S&P 500 rise enough to justify a 10% rise in the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, not to mention the bigger issue, which is if we had lower corporate taxes, corporations would stop spending a lot of money on avoiding taxes and investing in things that weren't profitable so they could avoid taxes and start investing in things that made them money instead. And I think that's a crucial issue. Jake?
This is absolutely true. And this is something that the two of us have been talking about for probably a decade.
Yeah.
The corporate tax rate is too high. Now, you can look at some statistics and you can see things like, well, we'll step away from statistics. That's dry, boring stuff. We can look at General Electric paying close to zero in taxes. We can look at Apple, and we can look at Google, and we can look at the big companies out there that aren't paying a whole lot in corporate taxes. And you say, well, the liberals will say, well, obviously the corporate tax rate isn't high enough. No, it just means we're on the wrong end of the Laffer curve. The Laffer curve, Arthur Laffer was the head of the Council of Economic Advisors to Ronald Reagan. And he coined this term having to do with taxes. When you raise taxes and revenue goes up, it means that you're below this point on the Laffer curve. Because if you just – let's look at the curve for a minute. If the government says you don't need to pay taxes, we're going to charge the country 0%, they will get zero revenue. If they go to the country and they say, we're going to charge you 100% of everything you earn, they're also going to get close to zero, because either people won't go out and earn because they won't get to keep anything, or there will be a huge black market. That's basically the Soviet Union right there at the end. If all of your earnings gets taken away from you and some of it's given back and some of it's given to other people, but you don't get the fruit of your labor, then you don't labor. So somewhere in the middle is the sweet spot. That's called the Laffer point, where the taxes are at exactly the right spot to get the most revenue so that people still want to go out and work and the government gets paid for. In the corporate tax rate, we're at that 100% kind of area. Even though it's not 100%, it's 35%, which is the highest top tax bracket for corporations in the world. That includes Nigeria. That includes Japan. Includes everybody. What that means is if we have the highest tax rates in the world and there are big companies that aren't paying it, we've hit the laffer point. They're doing it legally. They're doing things like not bringing the money home. They're doing things like structuring it so that it's a reinvestment in their own company instead of earnings. But the end result is that the government gets zero taxes for it. If you lower the tax rate to a place where it costs less to do the taxes than the schemes to avoid the taxes, people pay the taxes. I mean, if you think about what General Electric pays the people that devise the schemes so that they don't pay taxes, it's a tax in itself. They may pay somewhere between 10 and 15% of their earnings on the schemes to avoid paying 35%. So if we get the tax code written properly, where that it's equal and fair across the board, saying you, and by fair, I don't mean everybody pays the same rate. I mean, everybody knows what their rate will be. When you don't know what you're going to pay in taxes until you spend 12 hours doing your taxes on a personal level, that's not fair. When the corporations don't know even after they've spent months doing their taxes, it's also not fair. We need a clear and easily understood simple system, and that will cause revenues to go up on the corporate side.
You know, one of the funny things is that in 1986, we had a law passed called the Tax Reform Act of 1986, its original name.
Right.
And it was pushed through by Ronald Reagan. It was because the tax laws were so complex and so high at the maximum rates that it was just a nightmare. We simplified the taxes. Now, he is the one who, in essence, set the tax rate for corporations higher than individuals.
Right.
Prior to that, they were roughly equal. And since then, you know, but he lowered tax rates across the board, but eliminated a lot of deductions. Since then, it has become tremendously complex again. But the issue,
even more complex now than it was then.
The issue, the big issue that's going on across the world today, is in developed countries, corporate rates are lower than individual rates, and there's a really good reason for that. Dividends, which are a big chunk of what corporations earn, they pay out to their investors in dividends, are first taxed at the corporate rate and then taxed at the individual rate. So basically,
twice.
If you're an investor in a company and you're getting dividends, you get taxed twice on the same money, which makes the taxation really, really, really high.
It causes people not to pay dividends.
Across the world, the typical, for instance, in Europe, the typical corporate tax maximum tax rate is around 15%. But their personal rates are much higher than ours. In the United States, a corporation pays maximum tax rate of 35%, which, by the way, is way down from the 46% that was paid before Ronald Reagan.
Right.
And certainly a lot less than the 70% that was paid earlier. But this is the point that we need to look at. It's not just our tax code doesn't stand by itself. We're in a globalized world. If our corporate tax rates remain significantly higher than the rest of the world, expect to see corporations want to do business in the rest of the world because it's cheaper to do business in the rest of the world. It's better for their stocks. Whether we like it or not, a 15% corporate tax rate makes sense. Now, what does that mean on the backside? We're either going to run some big deficits going forward, huge deficits, or cut benefits to Americans, or cut defense, or cut Social Security, or cut Medicare, or individual rates will need to eventually go up.
Here's another key element here. It's important. Small businesses are paying it at the highest rate. Large businesses are finding methods of earning their money either overseas or scheming using very expensive methods to avoid paying the taxes completely legally. The lobbying has been done in effective ways so that there are a lot of things that they can do to avoid paying taxes. Donald Trump bragged about it. I mean, of course you're going to try to pay the least amount that you legally can pay in taxes. I don't care. I mean, this is true of Ben Affleck. Now, this is something I brought up a long time ago, Ben Affleck was really upset. This was back during George W. Bush. And he was saying he did his taxes and it was absolutely absurd the low amount that he had to pay. My response to it is very simple. If you want to pay more, there's nothing stopping you. You spent money on a tax preparer to get you the best tax deal. That's kind of the way our system works. If you feel like that's not high enough, volunteer some of your money. When we're talking about corporate tax rates, the schemes that come in place are only available to really, really high budgeted companies. So the small businesses have to pay. If we have a fairer system where it's less expensive to pay the tax than to avoid paying the tax, we should see on the corporate side the revenue to the government go up. What we're afraid of, and what you were just saying, is that by lowering taxes totally across the board, revenue to the government is just going to go down. And this is a simple point. Simple, as if any of this is really simple. We are still below the Laffer curve when it comes to personal rates. It means that when Obamacare had its taxes start hitting, that 3% tax on people that make more than $250,000. I don't know when that
couples.
Became
– It's couples.
Couples that make more than $250,000. I don't know when that became wealthy. I don't consider that wealthy. But for some reason, that was the number, and they said, okay, the 3% extra taxes. Revenue jumped. That means you can raise taxes and revenue goes up. That means that the taxes are at a reasonable rate for allowing people to continue to earn and still not go into a black market type situation, even if it's a legal black market. So when we lower those rates, revenue will drop. Do I think it's better for each individual citizen? Absolutely. Will it have a good impact on the economy? Yes, a fantastic one. Will it cause our debt at the national level to go up? Yes.
The Tax Foundation, by the way, has analyzed the Donald Trump plan as he presented it, or as his staff presented it.
I did a whole episode on that when it was still during right. the election.
But
yeah.
it will cut taxes by about, over the next decade, by about $12 trillion. It will reduce, and there will be some more revenue come in. But it
particularly
would,
the first
right,
year.
But it would reduce, if we left it in place for 10 years, it would reduce tax revenues by about $10 trillion. That's about $1 trillion a year over a decade on average of more deficit.
And we have a budget right now that spends about $4 trillion and only about 2.5 of that is coming in off of tax revenue. So if you lower the tax revenue by $1 trillion a year, you're talking about somewhere around $3 trillion of new debt going forward per year on average. That's not good. Now, is it good right now for us? Yes, but it's like trying to eat cake for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You can do it. And it sure tastes good at the moment, but you're going to have some long-term consequences. So we need to look at it long-term. What are we willing to sacrifice for the cake today?
Well, actually, the deficit this year was $600 billion, roughly.
Right. So it was so closer to $3 trillion in revenue.
Right. We take in about $3.4 trillion in revenue and spend about $4
trillion. Okay. And if we drop that by
A trillion dollars
a year, we're talking about $1.4 trillion of debt, new mm-hmm. debt instead of, or 1.6
right.
instead of just 0.6.
Which is, it's pretty, one of the more fascinating things that's come up is the reversal in the parties. The Republicans, in essence, have proposed a plan in Congress that matches fairly closely to what Donald Trump wanted, which is pretty smart because he got elected. And it's starting to take shape, and it amounts to spending a whole lot of money and reducing taxes so that the Republicans, the same people, by the way, in many cases, who insisted on balancing the budget and who did shut the government down a couple of times to reduce spending and who were loath to extend the debt ceiling, are preparing a program under a Republican president that would increase the deficit by about $1 trillion a year, which is an absolutely fascinating thing. Now, is that bad or good? Only time will tell. I personally think it will get whittled down, and what will happen is we will get a tremendous stimulus in the economy. Interest rates will go up, we'll pay more on the debt, and then we'll probably react to it down the road, which is, by the way, once we get the economy rolling with a good head of steam, we can afford to raise taxes back up again. Whether or not people actually do it is the question.
Right. And this comes back to something else I wanted to talk about, and I'm going to connect it. There's a big study that came out. And by a big study, I mean there were some really big names in this study. There are economists at Stanford and at Harvard and University of California at Berkeley got together and did a long-term survey on people age 30 and their parents at age 30. And This is the headline. You'll love it. Barely half of 30-year-olds earn more than their parents. Okay. That sounds pretty dreary. Does that sound dreary to you?
No.
Okay, good. The headline's dreary. What we're talking about is if you were born in 1945, if you were born in 1946, at your age 30, there was a 90% likelihood that you were making more money than your parents did at age 30. Okay, so born in 1946, if we just make a weird assumption and say that the parent was 30 years old when they had you, maybe 22 is a better. So let's say they were 22 years old when they had you as a baby in 1946. Well, that means that they were born in 1924. What were they likely doing for a living? I would hope that if you were born in 1946 and you were working at a factory, that you were making a lot more money.
Wait a minute. If you're born in 1946 and working at a factory?
Not in 1946. At your age 30, which is 1976, okay. Which is the peak of our industry cycle. That was the time that we had the most manufacturing jobs in the United States. If you go back to the 1920s, you've got people that have just come back from World War I that are trying to find jobs. We had a roaring 20s thing, and then we had the Depression. So at their age 30, should have been right in the middle of the Depression. If they're right in the middle of the Depression, well, I sure hope that in 1976, you were making more than they were in the middle of the Depression. What we have here is a very normal industrialization and modernization. It happens in companies, too. When Dell first founded, when Facebook first founded, when Apple first founded, when Microsoft first founded, they had these weird concepts. Like Dell said, I envision a future where there's a computer in every house. We snicker at that today. Well, of course there's a computer in every house. Well, not when he said it. Well, how many computers do you need in your house?
About 10.
About 10. Okay. Most people have two.
Well, yeah, I guess if you count your iPhone.
Well, even if you don't count your iPhone, most people have two. If you count your iPhone, you maybe have three or four.
Right.
Okay. How many do you need? That's probably it. You don't say, I want this computer for, well, unless you do it for a living.
No, I want all the computers in the world because I need them.
Right, right. Okay, General Bullmoose over there. The concept there is that once you've reached market saturation with a given technology, you've reached a maturity in that technology, and you need a new technology to have the big boost that happens next. And it happened with Apple right in the middle of the Great Recession. In 2007, they came out with the iPhone. Yeah, it wasn't that long ago. The iPhone pops up, and Apple has this massive boom. Everybody realizes they need to get one. It was a new technology. It led to a lot of new things. The same is true on a country level. When you're talking about revenue to the citizens, when people are earning things, one, you got to get good and productive. Two, you have to re-educate, and that's important. Because a big chunk of what we're seeing was the education process that took place after World War II. As they got the GI Bill, and a lot of people got college educated, which first time in their family's history that there was a college education in the family. Now, it's not so common to have somebody going to college for the first time in their family history. It's pretty normal to have some college in a family. That means that just like in a emerging technology country where somebody's going from standing barefoot in a rice paddy to working at a shoe factory, the earnings go up drastically. Well, working from the shoe company to a transistor company, the earnings don't go up quite as fast. And working from a transistor company to another form of microchip company, you can see where the earnings start flattening out. It's not such a steep growth curve until the next technology hits. America's great at innovation. And the fact that more than half of us today at age 30 make more than our parents did at age 30 is a direct statement against the people that are saying that America has been shrinking. If the average person, that's what more than half means, the average person makes more than their parents did, that means the average person is reaching the American dream. The American dream is, I want my child to do better than I did. And if the average person is doing it, you can look across at the countries of Europe and you don't see the same numbers. It's very normal in Europe to not make as much as your parents did when adjusted for inflation. And throughout most of history, it was very normal not to make as much or about the same as your parents did because you worked as a blacksmith and your dad was a blacksmith. And here's the last thing, which is the good news, the fantastically good news. This is not little good news. This is big good news, and it's not in these numbers.
It's bigly.
It's bigly. More people are working as a percentage of the population today than 30 years ago. More people are working as a percentage of the population today than even 8 years ago, even before the Great Recession. And this is something that doesn't show up well in the numbers because we've got dual income households. And in 1946, you had a single earner household. So if one person in your family is making as much as your parent did, and you've got two people in your family, because these numbers are based on hourly wages for a single person and the single earner before it. What it means is that we have had a good growth, and you can look at it in our GDP numbers. It's self-explanatory there. We've had a great deal of growth over the last 30 years, and it's because we've got more people working in the population. So that's the good news, and the thing that's missing out of the dreary headline that says barely half of 30-year-olds earn more than their parents did.
I'm going to correct one thing you said. Actually, our current labor force participation rate is approximately the same as it was in 1977. It went up dramatically. Yeah.
The labor force participation rate had a calculation shift in the 1980s. It started including people who wanted to be involved rather than just men.
Okay.
If you go back to the 1970s, it was tracking the percentage of working age men. It's now tracking the percentage of working age population.
Ah, okay.
So that's something that is very, very misleading in the numbers. We've got a lot more people. I mean, just think. In 1970, how many dual earner households were there?
So they just redefined the labor force, doubled the size of it.
Yes, and okay. Now it's a percentage of that labor force, and the number looks the same because it's a percentage of a greater number.
Okay, we really need to do the commercials, I want to talk about the carrier deal that Donald Trump pushed through, theoretically, and what it costs, and what the CEO of United Technologies said about it publicly afterwards, and what he's really going to be doing.
Sounds good. All right, we'll be back on the other side of these commercials with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to call in, the number in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back.
And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400, just in case you took a nap during the long commercial break and forgot the telephone number. I want to talk about what really happened at the Carrier plant in Indianapolis. And this is public information. You don't have to dig very deep because the CEO of United Technologies that owns Carrier was on Mad Money with Jim Cramer on Monday.
Not my favorite show, by the way.
And he explained what's going on. And he basically said they're going to, in fact, open their plant up in Mexico. He explained about the Mexican workers. Contrary to popular belief, their absentee rate is less than 1%. They love working on assembly lines and will do so for $5 an hour, and they're highly skilled. So economically, it just makes sense. If they're going to be competitive in making air conditioners that you will buy for your house, if they can pay $5 an hour and have a lower absentee rate and harder workers, which who are more productive, they raise their productivity dramatically by having Mexicans make it in Mexico. The alternative to that, of course, is having those same Mexicans come to the United States by sneaking across the Rio Grande. Now
you just sounded very unpatriotic.
Let me go on. So Donald Trump pushed this through, and I don't know where all the money came from. I haven't researched this, but basically they're going to get $7 million a year.
It's local tax incentives.
To retain not 1,100 jobs, as it turns out, but 800 manufacturing jobs and 300 administrative jobs in Indianapolis. Now, here's the interesting part.
That's 1,100 jobs. It's just not split the way that it
right.
sounded like.
It's not, and there's still going to be ultimately 2,100 manufacturing jobs will disappear. That's what from the Indianapolis paper. Now, here's the interesting part about that. The CEO fully acknowledged that the only way that plant can remain competitive is he's going to take the $7 million a year that he doesn't have to pay in taxes. Here, it gets better, folks. He's going to invest that money in computers and robots to increase the productivity of that plant. Now, it gets better. So he gets a $7 million tax break locally, basically a grant, okay?
Right.
He takes that $7 million and invests it in robotics.
They call that retooling at this point, but really what it is
right.
better robots.
And gets a federal tax write-off for doing so on his income and state and federal corporate income taxes. And by the time he gets done with that, he will replace almost all of the 800 workers that
with robots
whose jobs are being retained will lose their jobs. Not to Mexico. They will lose them to robots. Now, he said almost. It really boils down to the fact that if any of those workers, who average in their 50s, by the way, can learn to be robotics technicians while they're working on the assembly line building Carrier air conditioners, then they will be able to compete with everybody else on an equal footing to be robotic technicians to continue to have their jobs there, but the chances of that are pretty slim.
Right, and basically they don't get a better chance of getting a robotic technician job if they learn it while they're on the job. They get to go through the same interview process as all the other robotic technicians.
So it's headlines that he's retaining all these jobs, but the interesting thing is he also tweeted back at the head of the local union who said, This is not correct. He said it a little more bluntly on his tweet that, in fact, 2,100 manufacturing jobs are going to be lost here in this deal that supposedly keeps the jobs here. And Trump's reply was, if you were doing your job, the jobs wouldn't have moved away anyway.
Right. Like somehow the union who's organizing local people is going to be able to make the cost somehow better for the corporation. This is really important for people to understand. Until we get the unskilled labor retrained, we're not going to see a boost in our growth. Until we take the folks that were working at a Carrier plant that could be replaced for $5 an hour somewhere else, trained up in a skilled position where they're adding to the economy and getting paid what they earn,
Yeah.
Then we're going to see stagnation in Michigan and in Indiana and most of the manufacturing belt where they're trying to hang on to jobs that are no longer capable of paying them.
If you have to replace the air conditioner at your house this summer and you have two different brands of air conditioner, General Electric or Carrier, for example, I think General Electric still makes air conditioners. And one of them were very virtually identical in all of their aspects, and one of them cost 30% more than the other one. Would you pay the 30% extra? And the answer is probably no.
If they're the same quality, why would you?
And if, let's say, it's a Carrier air conditioner and it's made in Indianapolis and it's made in the United States, but, and again, I don't even know the General Electric, whoever competing air conditioning company can give you one with the same guarantees, the same quality record for 30% less. Now, bottom line to it is it may be more than 30% less because workers who assemble these in Mexico will work for 80% less.
Yes. And if you look at it this way, how do you buy an air conditioner? And the way you buy an air conditioner generally, unless you're building a new house, is your air conditioner just broke. You don't know why it's broken. You call the air conditioning repair person. The person comes out and says, oh, yeah, it's broken. It's going to cost you a lot of money to get it fixed. Mm-hmm. It's not a very efficient model anymore. We're going to want to swap this out with a new one. Well, what does the new one cost? Well, it's less expensive than what you paid 10 years ago for this one. Just like your TV.
They didn't actually say that.
No, they don't say that. But this is me stepping in to give a commentary on the side. Just like your TV, your television, that huge flat thing sitting in your living room and in your bedroom and in your kids' room. How many TVs did you have growing up? And what did they cost as a percentage of the income? The price on the televisions have dropped drastically. Are they being made in the United States?
No.
All of those televisions that you have hanging all over your house that had such great prices are not made in the United States for a reason, because you can't make them for that price here.
And
until you change your method of buying to say, I want to buy something that's a lot more expensive, that's an inefficient market, so that you can support someone patriotically, you have to recognize that you are in the same position as that CEO when he's moving the plant to Mexico. If he wants to stay in business, you're the person that's providing that new air conditioner says this one's 30% less expensive. It's still a Carrier.
This is what I think a lot of people, including the people who work at that Carrier plant, probably need to recognize. Walmart used to say made in the USA.
They don't say that anymore.
And the reason that they stopped saying that is their sales drops because people were buying it from Amazon that was made someplace else. You, like everybody else, given comparable quality, will go with the lower price.
That's just a normal thing because you've got money and you don't have lots of it. Nobody feels like they can just spend whatever they want.
If somebody comes to you and says, and you need your air conditioner repaired, and this is a really clear parallel. And the person says, okay, I'm going to charge you $25 an hour to repair your air conditioning system and clean out your ducts and do all this. And another person offers to charge you $5 an hour for the same quality of work. Now, literally, they couldn't do that, but I'm just using as this example. Would you pay the $25 an hour?
Or the $5.
Or the $5 an hour. And the answer is, if you can get the same quality, you'd be thrilled to pay. And we do this, by the way. Now, I want to point out here, I did a little informal survey here in Central Texas of the people who do lawn work, who mow lawns and take care of people's lawns all over Central Texas. And I made an interesting little discovery. Probably 80 or better percent of the people who are doing the work are getting paid less than minimum wage and are here illegally. Why are they here illegally? Because they get paid the equivalent, let's just use an example, $5 an hour, which is below minimum wage. But if you have a choice between two services that are going to do your lawn, and one of them will charge you twice as much as the other one, and you look at your lawn at the end and it's exactly the same quality of work, it's perfectly normal for you to go with the person or the group that is doing your lawn for half the price. And in many cases, by the way, the team leader, the person you talk to, is legally here. But if you check with the people about, if you actually go out and check, which I unfortunately did at one point, and said, let me see the work permits or evidence of residence of the people who are doing this lawn, and the guy said, no, we can't do that. And so I wound up getting someone else to do my lawn. And finally, I just gave up on it, by the way. Trying to find somebody who will do a lawn for a reasonable price, who, if I check their residence, which I'm not authorized to do, by the way, I was just asking, it isn't going
to
work.
What this really amounts to, and this is a good segue, what this amounts to is that the priorities that we put on other people are rarely the priorities that we have on ourselves. And the priorities that we put on other people are often dictated to us by people that make it sound really important. So here's another example. Starbucks has been lambasted back and forth. Fox News has talked about them. There's big statements about them, about saying happy holidays rather than Merry Christmas. I'm going to address this directly. Because it was something that was very prevalent when I was a child, when somebody would abbreviate Christmas to Xmas. And people were saying, you're taking Christ out of Christmas. Okay, this is a religious concept. Let me approach that really quick.
Okay.
The X, when you mark X where you're supposed to sign, that's the sign of the cross. That's historically what that means, that you would sign the cross as your name. So Xmas is an abbreviation for the cross. Holiday means holy day. So to say happy holy day to someone rather than happy Christmas is interesting, okay? A lot of the people that are really upset about not using the word Christmas are not Catholic. In fact, it's other denominations that are the most upset about not saying Christmas. They don't celebrate Mass. And Christmas is Christ Mass. And here's the last piece that I find absolutely hilarious that maybe makes me sound either unpatriotic or anti-religion, but let's just get it out there. People are really upset about what Christmas is being called. What does Christmas fall on this month? It falls on Sunday. Well, what is Sunday? That's the day of the sun. Monday is the day of the moon. Tuesday is Tuis, which is a Celtic god. Wednesday is Woden's day. That's Odin. Thursday is Thor's day. Friday is Frigga's day. Saturday is Saturn. These are names of pagan gods, and nobody seems to be upset about that.
Well, actually, you know, that X is the Greek letter C-H-I.
Right.
Chi, and it really is indicative of Christ. It's the first letter in Christ.
All of that came from the same subject as the carrier plant. When people are dictating to you why you should be upset about things that the people that just did them aren't even aware of, you should probably try to pick your battles. I mean, trying to change the calendar so that the days of the week are different names is probably not going to happen anytime soon.
I'd like to throw in something. You were talking about productivity earlier.
Yes.
Are you aware of what Amazon is doing in Seattle? Have you heard about this?
Which thing?
A big thing. They're opening up their first grocery store.
Yeah. Well, it's not their first grocery store.
Well, it's – really?
Yeah. They've got others. There's one in Texas.
Well,
there's in Austin.
The Amazon grocery store in Seattle.
It's just not available to the public. You have to order through it. The one in Seattle you can walk into.
Right. And it's only for their employees. It's a test. There will be no cashiers. You go in, you take what you want off the shelf, you walk through a little gate, you sack your stuff, and you leave. There are electronic identifiers on all the things that are sold in the grocery store
that are picked up
by the scanner.
Robots are taking jobs again, is what you're saying.
And they will then bill you on your Amazon account for whatever groceries you get.
Right.
And you can see it online. And it completely...
So we're losing manufacturing jobs and checkout line right. jobs. And
if Amazon has projected it and their initial tests indicate it is highly, it really is dramatically, they can offer a lower price.
Which people want. I want a lower price on my food.
And make a bigger profit on selling food in a grocery store than can the traditional methodology. And you don't have to scan it, by the way. You just simply put it in your cart. You take your cart to a place where you load it in bags, and you leave.
In the year 1900, 80% of the population was involved in agriculture. Then the tractor happened. In 1900, if somebody had said the tractor is going to replace all your jobs, the first response would be, that's not going to happen. The second response would be, well, what are we going to do then? And somehow we found new things to do.
Mm-hmm. New, more productive things to do.
New,
well,
more productive.
Didn't.
No, we didn't. The people that were alive at the time did. But we'll do it too. And this is one of the strengths of America, is that we're nimble on our feet and we can learn to do more productive things. It's why we have big booms coming out of recessions so often.
You know, when those people were replaced by the tractor, a lot of them never went back to work.
It's true.
Because that was the beginning of what we call retirement.
That's correct.
We didn't have retirement before that. So
it may be that all of us will be retired at age 14 from in the future when the robots do everything.
I don't think, you know, that was a prediction at one time that with all this new, this was back when I was a kid.
Gene Roddenberry, there's the idea.
Where the idea was that we're going to have so much leisure time, we won't know what to do with it all.
Well, I'm going to get in a starship and go exploring.
But in fact, the way human beings have evolved, if you look at the house they were living in 19, people were, the couple, average couple was living in 1970, and the house, and the, or the 1960s, and you look at the average house today, you'll discover
it's a lot bigger.
We spent a lot of money on a lot of things that we're paying for rather than taking leisure time and living at a lower standard of living.
Correct.
So now we have two, the average, you mentioned the fact, now we have an average two earner household as opposed to a one earner back then. We live in a much higher standard of living, and we spend a lot more money, and we feel stressed more so than we did back then.
Right. Or maybe the same, but we feel like it's more now. Anyway, we're about out of time for this week. Thank you for listening. If you did. If you didn't listen, then you can't hear me not thanking you. Ha! If you would like to contact us off the air, we give advice to high net worth folks on their investments and talk about specifics rather than generalized economies with our clients. You can call us locally at
254-947-1111. That's 254-947-1111.
You can reach that toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can also email us, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, The Personal Wealth Coach, or tpwc.com. Until next week.
Fair, balanced. Your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 K.